Welcome back and Happy New Year. I'm Rose Aguilar and this is Your Call. 2011 will go down in history as a year in which citizens used their collective power to make economic justice part of the national conversation. People in Wisconsin occupied their capital to block major cuts in public workers' rights and compensation. Occupy demonstrators across the country raised awareness about the widening wealth gap, inequality, rising student debt, poverty, and home foreclosures. Politico reported that a quick search of the news via Nexus revealed a significant rise in the use of the term income inequality from less than 91 instances in the week before the occupation started to almost 500 instances in November of 2011. So on today's Your Call, we are kicking off our first Agenda for a New Economy series of 2012 by talking about how we can create a more just economy. What questions should we be asking this year? How can the historic events of 2011 pave the way for a more just economic structure? How can we build on that momentum? What should be done to narrow the gap between the 1% and the 99%? And what should people be demanding? What are some real victories that can be won? And how can we keep economic inequality in the conversation during this election year? Today, we're joined by David Corton. He's co-founder and board chair of Yes Magazine and author of the book Agenda for a New Economy. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Delighted to be with you again.
It's great to have you back, and Happy New Year. We're also joined by Gar Alperovitz. He's a professor of political economy at the University of Maryland and founder of the Democracy Collaborative. Gar is author of America Beyond Capitalism. Hi, Gar. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So why don't we first start off by talking about how transformative 2011 really was in terms of challenging neoliberal ideas and really bringing inequality and also solutions to the table. What would you say, David, when you look back at 2011?
Well, I think the Occupy movement is just an extraordinary breakthrough. I've become very conscious that on the on the progressive side of the spectrum, we tend to focus on individual issues. And the Occupy movement has given us an overall framing umbrella with a focus on the issue of inequality. And I think it may be one of the most effective branding exercises in history in terms of the Occupy frame and the 1%, 99% theme, coming almost instantly to the fore of consciousness of the media and of all kinds of organizing, creating an umbrella in which we can coordinate, integrate our various efforts, and actually, in some ways, most exciting of all, create a frame in which we can actually talk to people who are, otherwise perhaps engaged with the Tea Party or even libertarians from across the spectrum, finding common ground on more issues than we might expect.
And what would you add to that, Gar?
Well, I agree with what David just said. What I think is most interesting about the Occupy movement, in an ironic way, is how they tapped into something that millions and millions and millions of Americans obviously felt. We would not be as kind of impressed with what they achieved, with really a small handful of people compared with the country, but the response tells you far more about where most Americans are than we had known before. The ideas that they about income inequality, the 99 and 1%, those ideas touch something in the understanding of millions of people that something is profoundly wrong in America. And I think that opening, both for the Occupy movement, but for all the other activities and activists, that's a critical understanding that we can begin to build forward on. And I think develop the groundwork for a long-term movement that is transformative of the economic system as a whole.
So what do you think are the best ways to really build on this momentum?
Well, my starting point with, it's a kind of walk on two legs policy is what I think, that's a Chinese expression. On the one hand, there are really critical things to do on income distribution and particularly on taxing not only the 1%, but the top groups above the 1%. So there's a whole tax strategy that I think Obama administration is just tiny bits of that they've opened up. And I think the movement can go forward on that. So it's a traditional strategy at the national level. It's a populist strategy, and it needs further development and mobilization, and it's clear there's room for that. But at another level, I think the critical issue is institution building and institutional change. Here, and David's done a great deal of good work on this, the question of the Wall Street financial system, really challenging the whole five big banks structure of that system, building state banks, city banks are beginning to be developed, credit unions, alternative forms of developing financial institutions and worker-owned companies and so forth, cooperatives. There are many forms of, that's the second leg to walk on, the transforming institutions, building from the bottom up at the same time we're dealing with these larger tax issues. So I think it's both and the opening is there for a long-term rebuilding effort at the community level as well.
What are your thoughts on that, David, as Occupy kind of gets together to come up with new strategies in the coming months? What do you think is most effective?
Well, I think the general frame that that Garth laid out is very important. One way I think about it is the we're dealing with two economies. The Wall Street economy is the 1% economy. The 99% economy is the Main Street economy. When the rules favor Wall Street, it's shifting power to the 1%, and it's also shifting power, shifting the whole economic focus away from creating real wealth for everyone to simply pumping up the financial assets of the 1%. The Main Street economy is really the economy of the middle class, where people get together and organize businesses that are rooted in community and that are in the business of providing good jobs to people to meet community needs. So one way I think about the agenda is it's a two-front agenda. Measures that weaken Wall Street, taxing the rich, financial transactions tax, a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. Move Your Money is a really interesting initiative because it actually literally takes the financial power directly away from Wall Street institutions and shifts it into Main Street institutions. But that's the kind of frame. And, all of the work that's going on in terms of local food movements, local finance, local sustainable energy initiatives. All of these are aimed at building the Main Street economy and are part of this power shift. And the wonderful thing about Occupy is that it provides an umbrella in which we can finally see and help the public see the interconnection between all of these issues and all these different initiatives. So they're no longer single purpose or single actions. They're all adding up to a deep systemic shift. And this, I think, is one of the things that is so important to bring into the conversation, that most of us on the progressive side are not trained to think in terms of systems, including economic systems. And I think this is, again, Occupy's opening up that conversation so that we begin to see how the pieces fit together.
And what we really wanted to do on today's show is talk about the questions we should be asking moving forward, because as you know, David, Agenda for a New Economy, our series, comes from the book that you wrote, and every Tuesday we talk about the economy. And last year, I sort of felt like I was hitting my head against the wall because we were asking the same questions about the banks and why no one had been held responsible. And we wanted to today really say, all right, so what should we do moving forward? What are the questions we should ask, and where can we really find some victories? But in order to do that, you really have to penetrate the system that has such a concentration of wealth and power in the hands of a few. So what are your thoughts about that? When you look at the latest numbers, for example, the Daily Beast reports that about 100 of the big money bundlers for President Obama's reelection team have ties to investment banks and other financial institutions.
Well, I think the first step in it is changing the story. And of course, Occupy has already shifted the story from the deficit to the to inequality and the dynamics and structure of inequality. So that's an important first step. I think also that part of what's very important to keep in mind is that the solutions are not going to come from within the political system as it's currently constituted. I think there's amazing arguments that we're much better off with a Democratic victory than a Republican victory, because the Democrats are less aggressively aligned with Wall Street interests. But we have a lot of problems with the government as well as Wall Street, and the real action, the real solutions are going to have to come ultimately from the bottom up, from people rebuilding their local economies, from moving their money, from creating state banks. Now, at the same time, we need to be shifting the conversation. We hopefully make it increasingly untenable for political candidates who are, you know, advocating more war, who are advocating essentially shutting down the government, who are trying to roll back or eliminate taxes on the rich. Those positions stand out increasingly as out of step with the needs of mainstream Americans and with the thinking of the time. So that begins, I think, to shift the political climate, and ultimately we've got to be bringing forward different candidates from both the Republican and Democratic parties to staff our political positions, but recognizing that ultimately the solutions have to come out of the economy. It's how we organize ourselves, how we organize our institutions, where we decide to work. And this, you know, is another thing that's really exciting. This, you know, this move that the Ivy League students begin to think of Wall Street careers as evil, as antisocial, instead of flocking to Wall Street. You know, these are indications of huge shifts in the basic zeitgeist and the political climate, political values that are going to play out through the political system. But I think the primary focus needs to be on what we do as citizens, advancing the conversation, building the new, discrediting Wall Street, and then a whole variety of solutions follow from that.
And Gar, before we get to those specific solutions, what are your thoughts on the best ways to penetrate this system?
Well, my experience with this is goes in a similar direction to what David has, but there's an aspect to it that I've found in speaking to the various Wall Street Occupy groups here in Washington and Boston and New York, has a certain resonance. And it begins with the notion that an awareness that 1%, I mean, the figures are staggering. 1% of the United States owns just under half of all of the investment capital. 1%. 5% owns about 70% of the investment capital. And those are medieval numbers, really. And I use that not rhetorically. That's the way medieval society was organized. And so there's an awareness that changing who owns, and here I really agree with the notion that we've got to talk about systemic change, not simply policy change. And at the core of, you know, what makes a system is who owns the basic wealth is the primary set of questions. And people kind of looking for a way to handle that, I think, have perked up in my experience when they realize that there are really 130 million Americans are involved in a different way of owning wealth. That's the co-op and credit union movement, one person, one vote. And there are something like 13 million people involved in worker-owned companies around the country. And people don't quite realize that this is possible, a different way of developing and owning wealth. And there are social enterprises and neighborhood corporations. So what the number of people I've talked to in the Occupy movement are beginning to see, moving to the community, just as David said, and working in the community is absolutely critical. But also, directly, it is possible in America to begin showing different ways to build on these historic trends and show a different way of owning one person, one vote development strategies that begin to change the way in which businesses, co-ops, credit unions, worker-owned companies, neighborhood corporations, laying a foundation for a very different vision and an ecologically healthy vision of what you can do starting at the bottom and building up. So I think there's a lot of power in that strategy. And it resonates with people who are trying to say, we really do want to change the system, change it in a way that changes ownership, but also changes how communities structures are built. And working hand-in-hand in the communities that I've seen with the small business community, there are alliances that can be made in this strategy as well.
There's a real key idea underlying what Gar is saying. We generally talk about the importance of equality, thinking in terms of equality, more equal distribution of income. But Gar is talking about the equal distribution of ownership, which in some ways is even more important. It's much more gets to the systemic root of the issue, that if ownership is broadly shared, and you know, not in the abstract sense of government owning everything, but in terms of people having a real ownership stake in their assets and their community level, that is what shifts power, and that is what ultimately then moves us toward a more equal distribution of income, which more and more research shows is the foundation of almost every essential aspect of a healthy society.
And that is David Corton. He's co-founder and board chair of Yes Magazine and author of Agenda for a New Economy. Gar Alperovitz is professor of political economy at the University of Maryland and author of America Beyond Capitalism. And today it's our first Agenda for a New Economy show of the year, and we're talking about how we can create a more just economy. What's at the top of your list in terms of demands? What are some real victories that can be won this year? And where do you see glimmers of hope for economic change? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. As we kick off the new year, what are some of the main questions you think we should be asking, and where should the focus really be when it comes to economic change? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment on our still fairly new website, yourcallradio.org. And let's go to our first caller, George in San Francisco. Hi, George. Welcome to the show.
Hey, you know, there are cultures where New Year's is celebrated at a different time on the calendar, too. So we're even looking for all kinds of models that we don't see exhibited every day. And the point of the call was we were just hoping, listening to your guest, one of your guests, say there are other models that already exist. For instance, cooperatives, where millions of people have contributed to an economic model. And yet, we don't think of them all the time. And one of the reasons is that they're not advertised intensively as the vast accumulation of fortunes, accumulation of capital is exhibited every day on major network television and satellites, et cetera. There might be an imbalance in the exhibition of models. We see every evidence that people go on accumulating capital, and what channel can we tune to where we will see examples or advertisements for the cooperative or the other economic strategy that also already exists and already is demonstrated to work? So for the year coming, we were thinking maybe we could find some way to get an agent to work on that.
Well, actually, we did a show about co-ops. I'm glad you brought this up. I think it was last year. And the organizations we had on, Gar, said the exact same thing. They said, this is just exploding, but we don't have a press department. We don't have the resources it takes to really get this in the media.
Let me just say a couple things about that, because I think, first, let me underline what the caller suggested. There is an enormous amount of experience on the ground and developing rapidly around the country. And if we have time, we can go into some really exciting models in Cleveland and other cities. So the fact is, millions of Americans are already doing this, and you can find out how to do it if they've done it in a difficult city like Cleveland. You can do it almost anywhere. So one, the main point is new possibilities exist and can be enacted. Secondly, you know, magazines like Yes Magazine are a terrific source of information for this, both on the website and the magazine. Programs like this one are important, and I'm my experience, and I suspect David's, is that there's more and more interest in radio and television programming to begin looking at this, the kind of thing that the media has not seen. It's the untold story, but boy, just beneath the surface, there is a tremendous base, a groundswell of activity. Finally, I guess David's book and my book, America Beyond Capitalism, are basically toolkits surveying some of this material with some systemic arguments also based, trying to show how they can be built. And finally, a webpage that we manage at the Democracy Collaborative, which is www.community-wealth. And really, it simply surveys what's going on around the country, which picking up on other websites that are specific to cooperatives or worker-owned companies and bringing it together and assembling it. But there are many, many new sources that the Internet also gives us and programs like this. So one of the tasks of this year is to begin, you know, getting the word out amongst our friends and who, people who want to get roll up their sleeves in the Occupy movement, that there is information available. We can do these things, and building awareness of it is part of the challenge.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent list that Gar laid out. Part of what's involved here is that, of course, Wall Street has promoted its investments on the basis of getting very high financial returns without the need to put any effort in or to do anything, engage in any labor on one's own part. The whole shift toward cooperatives and cooperative investment in cooperatives also requires a shift in mindset to, one of the other organizations I'm involved in is the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies. And the business folks in that alliance talk about a living return, which is not, you have to get a sufficient financial return to stay in business. But in addition to the financial return, it's the return of living in a healthy community with healthy social relationships, with a healthy environment. And that is really the foundational argument for investing in cooperatives, that it's an investment in your community, it's investment in your life, and in a good living. So that's got to be part of our story as we talk about cooperatives.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, George. Let's take one more call before break. Let's hear from Paul in Berkeley. Hi, Paul.
Oh, good morning. I was at Occupy Wall Street for a couple of weeks, and I had a sign that was very popular. It said, consider a maximum wage. And I just want to throw out the idea of thinking about having, on the other side of a minimum wage, the maximum amount that someone can make. And, of course, that would be prorated if somebody was like an athlete for 10 years or somebody had a family or whatever. But a maximum wage and a maximum amount of property that can be owned is just something I want to throw into the mix.
I think it's a great idea. Actually, the last chapter of America Beyond Capitalism suggests bringing the ceiling down on what can be held at the maximum wage and bringing the floor up over time towards a more egalitarian kind of systemic trajectory of change. Basically, that is, in effect, one way to do that is through the tax system. You know, a point about this that people don't often realize, the economy today, even in its doldrums and difficulties, is producing something like $200,000, just a little under, for every family of four. Now, we can look at how statistics are gathered and the meaning of GDP and so forth, but basically it is a very, very wealthy society already, and beginning to be aware of what that means and could mean if we began changing the distribution in a way that was more meaningful and more ecologically sustainable, starts with the fact that this society is not a poor society. This economy is not a poor economy. Mm-hmm. The potential here is for a very rich society, and the caller's right. You've got to start looking at the top if you really want to make for a kind of equitable distribution.
David, quick addition before we go to break?
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, I totally agree with Gar. I think it's an interesting question. I'd be interested in Gar's thoughts on it. Is the best way to achieve that, bringing down the top, which is essential, through setting limits on income or through a strongly progressive tax system? It's kind of a question of which is easier to administer. Mm. And do you have a thought on that, Gar?
Well, before you answer, Gar, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll come back with that question and really talk about what solutions are at the top of both of your lists. We're talking today about the questions we should be asking this year about the economy. What should people be demanding? What are some real victories that can be won this year? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this.
Hello, this is Chuck Feeney of Your Legal Rights. If you're overwhelmed with debt, please join me this Wednesday evening at 7 on Your Legal Rights. The topic will be bankruptcy law. My guest will be Wes Avery, a past chair of the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, and Leon Baer, who's given a great amount of time for Call a Lawyer Night. Both are certified specialists in bankruptcy law. That's this Wednesday evening at 7 on Your Legal Rights here on 91.7 KLW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there, and you can leave a comment about today's topic, the economy, what should we be demanding, and what are some real victories that can be won. Tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about the Republican Party. Who is the base of the Republican Party? Who's leading it? Who's paying the bills? And what does it really stand for? That's tomorrow's show. And then on Thursday, we'll have a conversation about how communities can get together to change local laws. That's Thursday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join today's show, it's our first Agenda for a New Economy series of 2012. We're talking about what it will take to create a more just economy. What should we be demanding? What are some real victories that can be won? Where do you see glimmers of hope? And when you think about the changes you'd like to see this year, what's at the top of your list? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Is it a limit on income? Is it a progressive tax system? Is it a Robin Hood tax, a financial transaction tax, a higher minimum wage, living wage? What's at the top of your list? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We're joined today by David Corton, author of Agenda for a New Economy and founder, co-founder and board chair of Yes Magazine. Gar Alperovitz is professor of political economy at the University of Maryland and founder of the Democracy Collaborative. He is author of America Beyond Capitalism. So, Gar, what would you say is at the top of your list, and what do you think is actually realistic? Would you say a limit on income, a progressive tax system?
Well, top of the list for me is back to the institution building, where I think that's where the power is going to come from, changing in the communities. But taxing at the top is very important. Financial transaction tax is one. But, you know, most of the income, we were talking earlier about the fact that the economy is producing just a little under $200,000 per year if you average it out for families of four, whereas people at the top are making much, much, much more. Most of the additions at the top are not salary. They are taken in the form of stock options and gains from the speculation that occurs with the stock options and the stock market. So taxing that part of it in particular, the unearned part of it, would be a powerful way to get at it. So I think that really looking at the top, bringing up the bottom, but building new institutions that suggest ways on the one hand to reclaim community, anchoring jobs, for instance, worker-owned companies, and as I say, there are thousands of them that people just don't know about, help build a community. They stabilize. They don't get up and leave the way corporations do. And at the same time, they give people a sense that ownership can be cooperative, can be something that everyone shares, rather than just the tiny 1% that now has almost 50% of the capital, investment capital. And I think give a different image of the systemic change in that way. That, as David emphasized, we've got to begin talking about systemic ideas rather than simply projects and proposals. One other thing that I noticed, and I'm sure some of the folks listening in probably noticed, when you talk about any of these worker-owned companies, cooperatives, changing the banking system, state banks, and so forth, immediately the charge of socialism comes up. What is quite interesting is whether we call it socialism or cooperatives or public banks, the poll data shows there's been a change for people in the range 18 to 29. I just saw a poll the other day who have more positive view of socialism than a negative view, and it's been increasingly positive as the Wall Street crisis has gone on and as the Occupy movement has come up. 49% in the latest poll on this favorable idea of what socialism is 43% negative, and that's a reversal from 2009. Whatever that means in terms of abstract words like socialism, what I think it really tells us that people are open to new ideas of many, many kinds and are searching for a way beyond what we're now looking at in the concentrated wealth of the corporate system.
And David, what would you say is at the top of your list? And what are your thoughts on what we've been hearing from some people in and out of the Occupy movement, that there really needs to be demands? So, for example, money out of politics, more regulation of the banks. Are those priorities for you as well?
Yeah, I would say all of the above. Now, there's different roles here, and one of the things that Occupy is doing is creating a forum for a new conversation. And I think you know, there's a great wisdom in that movement that, you know, however it was constituted, in not coming forward with a specific list of demands other than the demand that we create a society that works for everyone. Now, in terms of policy actions, I think the issue of a constitutional amendment to make clear that corporations are not persons, make that sufficiently clear that even members of the Supreme Court can understand it, is absolutely foundational on both the political and the economic side. But in terms of questions, one of the things that Gar and I are both working on with the New Economy Working Group and New Economy Network is the question of what do we need to be doing to prepare for the next Wall Street crash. Mm. Now, there's almost universal agreement beyond the most strongest Wall Street apologists that nothing consequential has changed since the last crash, which means that another crash is almost inevitable.
Right.
Now, what we don't want to see is when that crash happens is the government stepping in again with a huge bailout for the biggest banks and a process of resolution that actually leads to even further bank consolidation. And the question itself creates a frame in which we can begin to have a much deeper conversation about what should a functional money system, a functional finance system, look like. And to me, the key issue there is the question of whether the power to create and allocate money is concentrated in Wall Street institutions that are focused only on private financial return, completely disconnected from community interests, and operate totally beyond any kind of public accountability, or whether we have a decentralized money system that looks more like the one we had when Gar and I were growing up, with a system of community-based financial institutions, community banks, mutual savings and loans, credit unions, and so forth, which allow communities to create their own credit to finance their local economies, finance real productive activity. And so I think the money system is the most opaque of our issues, but it defines the ultimate system of power in society, both over our economic and our political system. And so getting that conversation going about what should a functional, positive value financial system look like is, to me, the foundation of the really deep changes.
Well, we have full lines, so let's go through a few calls, and then we'll get our guests to respond. Let's hear from John in Berkeley. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, and how are you? Thank you for this program. I come from a very different point of view. I am an independent with libertarian leanings, and I find that both parties, both Republicans and Democrats, deliberately keep certain constituencies in a form of captivity because they say they advocate for this constituency side, say with the Republicans, the National Rifle Association, the Second Amendment, and with the Democrats, the reproductive choice people, and they keep them captive. In other words, if you don't support us, you're going to be set to those big bad Republicans or those big bad Democrats. I think these parties keep us divided. And the one thing I will say about the Occupy movement and the Tea Party movement as well is that they are beginning to show cracks in the facades. Now, I think the thing that those of us out there should consider very seriously is turning our backs on the major parties and working with independent candidates. Mm. One more thing before I go, and that is you mentioned the Republican Party for the next program, is that I've gotten it off the net that the Republican leadership was going to do everything in its power to prevent Ron Paul from getting the nomination. Now, like Ron Paul or not, he's asking a lot of questions which no other candidates ask. And that is a very good thing, that both Democrats and Republicans are finding that they have more in common than they have differences. And it's only the leadership of these parties that is keeping them divided. And thank you again.
Well, thank you, especially on foreign policy. And thank you for the call. Please call in tomorrow when we talk about the Republican Party. We'll follow that show with a show about the Democratic Party, and then we'll talk about third parties. But thank you for calling. We'll get a response in just a minute. Let's hear from Ede in Berkeley. Hi, Ede.
Yeah, we need two things. First, collectiveness. We need far more people demonstrating in the street because, really, the American people have been robbed by the Wall Street people. I mean, everything was based on the stock market, not what is good for the American people. So send their factories overseas, send their jobs overseas, just destroy, they destroy the whole society. Then the second thing, we need accountability. Who do we hold accountable for all of this damage? And we have to go after them. We actually have to start a RICO case against many of the banks, Goldman Sachs, other banks. We also need to hold Obama responsible for the continuation of this bailout that George W. Bush started. He had no right to give these people, you know, trillions of dollars. Meanwhile, American people have been not able to find food for their families. The last thing I like to, what I recommend we do. First, we have to really start doing whatever we can to get rid of the lobbyists. Second, we have to think seriously about putting ceiling on the wealth. Why anybody per individual? Do you really need more than $100 million to live the rest of your life? No, you don't. And the last thing is we have, as Americans, unite in one voice against all of these criminals that have taken over this country 30 years ago, started Reaganomics and trickle-down economy and all of this garbage. And I'm very, very pessimistic about the next election because you have the Republican Party, which have nothing at all in goodwill for the American people, and you have the Democrats, which are not much farther behind.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Ed. We did a show a couple of weeks ago about accountability. A former executive from Countrywide says that people deserve to be in jail, and yet this woman has not been interviewed by the DOJ. So you might want to check out that show. Thank you for calling. Let's hear from Gabriel in San Francisco. Hi, Gabriel.
Hi, Rose. How are you?
Good, thank you. Hi, Gabriel. Go ahead.
I have been listening, great ideas, fantastic, but none of them will be implemented without politics. So The main thing, we have to change the way we elect our politicians, because you don't have to be a millionaire. There are a lot of nice people in America, very, you know, educated, but they cannot run because they don't have any money. So if you don't change that, nothing will be changed. And also those two parties are the same, Republican and Democrat, they've been there for years. What about the third party? What about, you know, trying to... Some people give you a chance to run.
Well, thank you for calling in. We're getting a lot of comments about third parties and exactly what Gabrielle just said, that in order for these changes to come, you have to change the political system. David Corton, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, very interesting set of questions. First of all, in prosecution, you know, there's nothing I'd like more than to see the Wall Street crooks in jail. That's one area where I'd be happy to expand the prisons. On the other hand, the truth is that simply prosecuting the evildoers on Wall Street is not in itself going to change the system. In fact, you know, the rules have been rewritten by those guys to the extent that, you know, far too much of what they do that should be criminal is actually legal. And I think prosecution in some ways is a distraction, that the most important thing is to move forward the agenda, change the rules in ways that fundamentally shift power back to people. Now, the very interesting questions, I feel quite sympathetic with the independents and the libertarian perspective here, that to the extent that we recognize that both parties are basically corrupted in their current form, and we need to think independently about the candidates we support. Now, the difficulty, of course, with the third party movement is that the way our political system is structured, a third party almost inevitably ends up playing a spoiler role in the actual elections. Now, one way the Tea Party gained its power was to pick out candidates and support them within particular candidates within the Republican Party. Now, I think the Tea Party actually got somewhat co-opted in that thrust by the Wall Street money interests. But the basic strategy has, I think, a lot of merit to it of finding and supporting candidates who take a truly independent view, who are clearly independent of Wall Street, and then supporting them within the electoral system, within one or the other of the two existing parties that basically, until we change the electoral rules, dominate the process.
And Gar, what are your thoughts? We also got calls about divide and conquer. We need far more demonstrations.
One way to think about it, I was listening to the calls and also what David was saying, and one way to think about this, and I think it's a matter of perspective as well as a matter of immediate tactics. I come at this in part as a historian. That is to say, it is clear that the political system is highly leveraged by money and power right now and locked up and can be challenged only in part through techniques like the Tea Party is doing and the Occupy movement. But essentially, the system is very, very locked and controlled by, small numbers of very powerful groups and institutions. So we can chip away at it in the way I think that David was talking about it. That's very important. But if you look back at the history of the progressive movement or the populist movement or the New Deal, what's really important is the decade and one or two or three decades of development before you got to the place where you cracked open national politics. Doesn't mean there aren't things that can't be done, and I totally agree. It's not only that the experts understand what's going on in Wall Street. Most financial experts, left, right, and center, are predicting the next financial crisis, mm-hmm. that they will recur, and there'll be another Wall Street crisis. So being prepared on that one may be a target of important opportunity right away. But on many other issues, it's building the institutions from the bottom up, the supporting community businesses, supporting sustainable communities, cooperatives, worker-owned companies, city banks, state banks. There are 15 states that are considering single-payer Medicare programs, state control and domination in the credit union structures. Rebuilding that whole infrastructure is a step-by-step prehistory of the next great era. So I think what we've got to do, the way to think about it, is walk on two legs. Do whatever can be done at the level of current politics, realizing it's a system that's highly locked up and you can make inroads occasionally, but focusing on where we really can develop, which is at the localities and the states, with a longer-term time horizon. We're talking about systemic change in the most powerful system in the history of the world. Mm. We need to build up over time the ideas, the projects, the people, and the tactics. And I think looking at it that way, you begin to get some hope from past movements that, in fact, have done just that and succeeded.
That's Guy Alpervitz. He's author of America Beyond Capitalism. David Corton is author of Agenda for a New Economy. And we have about 10 minutes or so. Let's take some more calls, and then we'll get a response. Let's hear from Catherine in Santa Cruz. Hi, Catherine. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm loving this show. It's so important. And I wanted to speak to, I'm sorry, I don't know if it was Gar or somebody else, but talking about how you become a spoiler when you're not a Democrat or Republican. And I'm very used to that because I've been in the Green Party for a long time, and before that for the rest of my voting life and peace and freedom. And I always vote my conscience. But what I really think could change things more than just about any other idea I've ever heard of is if we institute instant runoff voting, and maybe somebody there would like to explain what it is. I could, too, if you'd like. They'd probably do a better job. But it wouldn't have spoilers be part of the equation then. And it would also, really importantly, open up the dialogue with the people that are running, because they wouldn't just be talking about the very limited things that Democrats and Republicans might refer to. And so I every time I talk to people about instant runoff voting, they haven't heard of it.
Huh. Do you have that in Santa Cruz?
No, we don't, but I think they do something in San Francisco regarding instant runoff voting.
We just voted for our mayor with instant runoff voting.
Where do you live?
In San Francisco.
Oh, right.
Yep.
Exactly.
Yep. And in Oakland.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it saves money. That ought to appeal to Republicans and libertarians, if nobody else.
You know, we need to do a show about instant runoff voting because there's been a lot of debate about the Oakland, especially mayoral election with IRV. So that you just gave us a good idea. I'll bring that to our editorial meeting. Thank you for the call, Catherine.
Thank you so much.
Let's go next to Millie in Berkeley. Hi, Millie. Welcome to the show.
Hello. A terrific program, and I'm learning a lot. But I'd like to say what I think anyone can do today. And that is move their money from a big bank, I'm afraid I bank with one of the biggest, and take away then some of the financial power that you're talking about. all the other issues require us to call our congresspeople, call the president, and I think we should do it. I think that I think they pay attention to the number of calls they get on particular issues. So thank you very much.
And are you planning to move your money?
I am.
Okay, good. Thanks for calling.
I am. I need help to do it because I'm blind and I can't do it all by myself. But I'm collecting names of community banks and independents and so forth.
All right.
I don't need to mention the one, but it's one of the two biggest, and I don't think they need my money, even if it isn't a great deal.
Well, let us know if you need help, Millie, because we did a show about Move Your Money just a couple weeks ago.
Okay. Well, I'll check on that.
Okay. Thank you for calling in. Let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg.
I hope I can articulate this just on the fly, sort of. I'll turn my radio down again. Sorry. I don't disagree with much of what I've heard. As a matter of fact, I agree with probably most of what I've heard. But I think that trying to get from where we are, A, to where we need to go, B, is going to be a big task. I mean, and you're right, there's a sort of a timeline here that's much more extensive than people would like to think. But I wanted to throw something else into this. I've heard it mentioned a little bit, but I think there needs to be a complete change in thinking about virtually every institution that exists in our society. And the reason I say that is because I look at a book, and I think you may have even done something on this, Richard Hindberg's book, The End of Growth.
Yes.
I think that some people really need to read that book because this is going to mean a complete shift in the way people look at economics, politics, et cetera. And that's where I mean about the change in thinking, because Hindberg just says this can't go on. I mean, for a number of reasons. Capitalism is really going to, destroy the planet if allowed to continue to grow the way it is. People aren't even thinking in these terms. They may be thinking locally, but they're not thinking in terms of really questioning the values and the kinds of thinking and institutions that we have in this country.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. We have just a couple minutes left. So David, why don't you respond to that? And you have written about this. You talk about how we're taught from birth that capitalism is synonymous with markets, democracy, and individual liberty. Do you think that this current economic crisis is really creating a crack in this, widely held belief, really?
Well, I think so. I mean, the point that I make is that capitalism presents itself as the champion of markets and democracy and liberty. In truth, it is exactly the opposite. The Wall Street capitalism is a process of wealth concentration and of the corruption of democracy. And the market economy, as I learned about it, and as Adam Smith wrote about it, looks a whole lot more like a local farmer's market than an economy ruled by Goldman Sachs, Monsanto, and Walmart. It is really the local economies, the decentralized economies, the kind of broad participation and ownership that Gar's talking about, that is the foundation of real democracy and real markets. So that's a key shift in frame, and I do think that our current situation is bringing that to the fore. I also want to mention very quickly, in terms of specific issues, that I've been involved in a number of transpartisan dialogues between people on the left and right, particularly Greens and Libertarians, and it's fascinating that there are two critical issues. One, the idea of a constitutional amendment to make clear that corporations are not persons, actually has broad transpartisan support. There also is, I think, a shared concern about the Federal Reserve, which is a conversation that begins to open up the whole discussion about the structure of the money system. Now, the Ron Paul types would like to just simply do away with the Federal Reserve. I don't think you can run a modern economy without a central bank, but it needs to look very different than the Federal Reserve we have now. So that's another huge conversation that has energy across the political spectrum. But we need to be moving on all fronts, and that can be very discouraging at one level, and yet it is also a huge breakthrough to recognize that we're not going to solve this with any specific policy change or action, and that it's going to require the cooperation of a huge number of groups, and it is also going to require that that those of us at the grassroots break through the divisions that that the 1% have cultivated to maintain their power.
And also, this is going to take time.
Yes.
I mean, a lot of time, right? Gar, would you?
Well, I think that's the central issue. That it building from there again, walking in on two legs. There are things that need to be done at the national level, and when the next financial crisis hits, and I think there may be some real opportunities there, and that's necessary. But rebuilding from the bottom up. I'm from Wisconsin originally, and what's going on in Wisconsin gives you a sense of it. Challenging the governor, but also building on co-ops and worker-owned companies and local economic development. Building that vision, and also beginning to ask, what do we do about these big, giant corporations under any system? Do we socialize them? Do we make them public enterprises? Do we break them up? Those kinds of questions are on the horizon. My own sense of it, and the language I use in America Beyond Capitalism, is we need a pluralist vision of commonwealth from small businesses and co-ops and really at whatever appropriate to the scale. And a developmental vision that really, and here I agree entirely with David, starts at the bottom, does our homework at the bottom, organizes folks who are not actually ideological very often. That's our experience working in various cities, that you people who are called conservative, liberal, radical, if you have programs and policies that actually make sense, an institution development that makes sense, a lot of the rhetoric disappears when you really get down to what should we do here in this community now. And building from that, I think, is the key to the future.
Gar Alperovitz is professor of political economy at the University of Maryland and author of America Beyond Capitalism. And David Korten is co-founder of Yes Magazine and author of Agenda for a New Economy. Thank you both for kicking off our Agenda for a New Economy series, and we'll definitely have you back and continue this discussion. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call, and here's what's coming up tomorrow. Who are the Republicans? On the next Jour Call, we'll have a conversation about the Republican Party. With the 2012 election cycle ramping up, we're asking some basic questions. Who is the base of the Republican Party? Who's leading it? Who's paying the bills? How has the party changed over the years? And what are its principles and goals? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What's your opinion of the Republican Party? And what do you want to know about it? It's Jour Call with me, Rose Aguilar. And you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor. And Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.